Mr. Smeltzer, you may begin when ready.
Sure. May it please the court. My name is Joshua Smeltzer and I represent the appellants. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. So this case involves tax deductions that the appellants took on their tax returns, and they did so for business activities that they both engaged in. The denial by the Internal Revenue Service of these deductions caused them to file a refund suit in the district court claiming that those deductions were valid. The United States won on motion for summary judgment, but we believe that summary judgment motion failed to consider all the evidence that was in the record that supported those claims. For the denial of both of the claims, both the business activities of Mr. Johnson as an orthodontic surgeon and of Mrs. Johnson as a real estate professional, were essentially denied based on substantiation claims, that the court decided that the evidence that was presented was not enough to justify the deductions claimed. For Mr. Johnson, it was based on a false premise that the only evidence that was submitted to support his deductions were the tax returns alone. And the record does include more than the tax returns in order to support those deductions.
But counsel, did you raise those other records to the district court? Because when I was reviewing the summary judgment motion, I didn't see that. I think there was only a citation to Exhibit 18.
There was a general claim that the taxpayers had submitted sufficient evidence to support the claims. But in addition, the evidence that we pointed to in our opening brief was evidence that was contained in the United States motion for summary judgment. It was part of the testimony that was submitted as the deposition. And so it was included in the record as evidence that would contradict the claim that the only evidence was the tax return. Regardless, that claim alone is false based on what was submitted and what was within the record.
But you would agree, though, you didn't cite that evidence to the district court in your office.
So we would agree that the briefing at the lower court wasn't necessarily as specific as it was supposed to be. The district court notes the lack of specificity in there. But on appeal, it does not mean that as a de novo review, we believe that the entire record needs to be considered and whether or not a material fact exists for trial. And we do believe that it does if you look at the record as it was cited. Because Mr. Johnson did testify about both the existence of his activities and what they were, and they were beyond the tax returns. He testifies about flights to various locations of these surgery centers, and he testifies about what he did there, and it wasn't insubstantial investor type activity that would be excluded as passive activity. He was training other surgeons. He was showing them how to do more complicated activities and other activities that would show that there was material participation there.
He did have that, but I don't know that it was backed up by the number of hours he needed under the Internal Revenue Code. What I'm referring to is that his work at the Las Vegas office. Mm-hmm. At ER 455, he says, I hate to say, I don't remember in 2008. I guess 3 to 4 days a week, part days, we'd be there. Myself, my partner, associate we hired, that's probably typical. And then at 466, he says, I could have been a day, half a day, a week. It could have been 3 days a week. We also hired at some point an associate to work at Clear Choice. So I don't know from reading that how many hours he was putting in over there at the Las Vegas office. Can we figure that out from that?
From that testimony alone, it isn't clear, right? But a half a day could be estimated as 4 hours and the other ones, and you could add it up to do that. But I think the real problem is that none of that analysis was done. And instead, I mean, the reason for the denial is that there was no evidence beyond the tax return. And that just isn't true. There was evidence. Whether or not that evidence was sufficient, whether or not Mr. Johnson's testimony or the airplane logs, or if you added them up and made an estimate, whether or not that's reliable enough, or whether or not it gets to the threshold, that's not an issue that was ever decided, because the summary judgment was denied as a threshold matter, just saying that the tax returns alone weren't enough. And we think,
Mr. Smeltzer, I think the argument you're making is contrary to the law of the circuit, that a grant of summary judgment can be affirmed on any basis supported by the record. So I think what you have to argue is that, you know, the record as a whole doesn't support the judgment of the tax court, which is not the argument you're making.
Well, we are making that the record as a whole has sufficient evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact. And as such, summary judgment wasn't appropriate. Whether or not it would have been sufficient to ultimately render a decision, that's something that would be decided at trial. But we believe that the record clearly shows that there was a genuine issue with regard to material fact, and most importantly, that at least the reason for the denial is wrong. It isn't that the taxpayers only submitted their tax returns. There was evidence in the record that was available in order to be considered beyond that, that does raise, we believe, a genuine issue of material fact.
It seems like to me you want a do-over of the summary judgment motion, right? Because the evidence wasn't marshaled to the district court, you marshaled it again to us. You want us to do it de novo.
I don't think that we're specifically asking for a do-over. What we are indicating is that even though the summary judgment briefing may not have been as specific as it was supposed to, that didn't mean that there wasn't evidence there that could have been presented at trial. And regardless, as long as that evidence is present, we believe that the taxpayers were entitled to have that resolved at trial, not at summary judgment, because at least the inferences were there that the court should have made in their favor, such to say that that it was at least an issue that needed to be resolved, not on summary judgment, but considering all the facts, considering all the evidence, and having a trial.
Are you saying that the district court should have searched the record for facts to support your claim?
I don't think it would have needed to search the record. I know that it does mention that Exhibit 17 was a very large exhibit, and that's what it references when it says it shouldn't have to hunt for things in there. But the items that we cited in our brief don't all exist in that voluminous exhibit. As I mentioned, a lot of them, the testimony of both Mr. and Mrs. Johnson explain the existence of these logs, and they also give detail with regard to the activities that were involved there. I think that is sufficient enough to show that there was a dispute over what activities Mr. Johnson actually engaged in the tax year at issue, and whether or not those were sufficient, both in the type and the amount. And that was an issue that we believe, and all we need is one issue in order to, you know, if there's an issue that needs to be resolved at trial, then it should have been resolved at trial. And that's our argument.
Well, the testimony I cited to you, it looks like it was an after the fact ballpark estimate that he was given in his testimony. Was there any better evidence than that?
I don't believe that the quality of the evidence is necessarily a bar to us being given a right at trial. So he does have that evidence there, and it's clear that the evidence obviously isn't as specific as the taxpayers would hope. But Regardless, the evidence is there. Now, the tax code is very flexible in what you can use to prove your hours and to prove material participation. It can be witness testimony, and it can, especially, and it has more credibility if it is corroborated by contemporaneous logs.
But it can't be post-event ballpark estimates, can it? And that's what we have from his testimony.
So the, as long as the testimony and the recollection of the witness is credible, I believe it can be. Now, granted, that reliability would have to be judged by the trier of fact, and it may not end up in their favor. But regardless, the fact that there could be testimony and was testimony that he could have participated, I think shows that he was entitled to at least have that issue done at trial and to have it explored further. And beyond just a dismissal as a threshold matter, that there wasn't anything beyond the tax return. Okay, and I mean, on the on similar notes, the same thing was done with the real estate professional as well. Our argument basically there is, since time is a little bit waning here, the argument basically there is that Mrs. Johnson, we don't believe that Mrs. Johnson can be disqualified based on the 750-hour requirement, based solely based on a complete look at all the evidence, which the court didn't do. When the court cites the logs, it cites the log, but it doesn't point out which one that is. And we believe that if you consider—
Can I ask you, are you challenging the district court's ruling that her time for studying for the license does not count as work? Or service for the purposes of the 750-hour rule?
We are challenging the entries related to that. And the reason that we're challenging the entries related to that is because on the original log, there are specific real estate license entries. On the revised log, those are expanded to include other things that were originally listed as studying and computer and other items that in Mrs. Johnson's testimony indicate could include a variety of activities, all of which we believe would qualify as part of the 750 hours. So to the extent that the real estate study entries, if it's purely real estate study, then there are decisions that say that those do not qualify. But we don't believe that those entries are definitive in saying that they are purely real estate study. And if you look at the original logs and the revised logs and you combine those together, we believe that it at the very least creates a substantial issue of material fact regarding those. And that's true of the requirements involved. And again, the standard is flexible so that you can prove it. And there we do have contemporaneous logs. And the Justice Department's briefing, even when they do it, they have to ignore one set of logs, use the logs they like. And even then, we're only a difference between 10 or 15 hours between qualification and not qualification. We believe this is a very close call.
Thank you, counsel. You want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes.
Mr. Wasserman?
Good morning. May it please the court. Let me direct my initial comments to Mr. Smeltzer's claim that this is a substantiation case. The government doesn't believe that it's a substantiation case. He talked about the evidence presented to the district court with respect to Dr. Johnson, the 1,000-page exhibit. Now, it is true that the parties have a duty to keep books and records under 6001, which it appears that the Johnsons largely did not do. They effectively made the government their record keeper by issuing a FOIA request to the government. But what upset the district court was the essentially throwing a 1,000-page document on the bench and saying that Dr. Johnson's proof is in there somewhere. It would be like taking a deck of cards saying, well, I have 52 cards, there are four aces in this deck, therefore I win. That is unacceptable. That's what Carmen versus San Francisco Unified School District says. It says that that you don't make the district court judge your attorney to do your work. And that's what, why the grant of summary judgment was appropriate with respect to Dr. with respect to Dr. Johnson.
We could affirm on that Carmen basis alone.
With respect to Dr. Johnson, that is correct.
What about Mr. Meltzer's argument that, well, this is de novo review and we could look at it as presented?
Well, then I would go with what Judge Reyes said, that the fact is, first of all, I would say if Carmen means anything, then it means that it's appropriate for this circuit to reject an effort by a party who does not point to specific facts in dispute. That is this circuit's requirement. Point to specific facts in dispute if you want to avoid summary judgment. If you don't do that, then a summary judgment can be granted. They didn't do it. What they want is exactly what I think His Honor said before. It's essentially a redo, and that is not appropriate. I would also cite Downs versus Los Angeles Unified School District, which was cited by the lower court. However, to the extent that if you were to go outside of those cases, the fact is Dr. Johnson testified that he would be unable to specify any expenses, whether they were reimbursed or not, nor could he pin any hours, specific hours, to any work he did in his pass-through partnership. So therefore, he's acknowledged already below that he would not be able to prove his case.
Before you move on, what about the testimony that says with regard to Clear Choice Las Vegas, I was there, I guess, 3 to 4 days a week, at least part-time. Why is that not enough to substantiate his time?
So I think there'd be two answers. First of all, in his deposition, he needs to say exactly what he did. The only evidence that he had to substantiate that claim were his airplane logs. And those were, I believe, considered, we argued that they are inherently unreliable. But even that, be that as it may, unless he can show his continuous, substantial, and regular contacts for 500 hours with his business, he can't meet it, even if this court would allow a do-over. And I think the second point I would make...
Can I ask you a quick question? The airplane logs, if they show flights to Las Vegas, where his office was, how is that inherently unreliable?
Well, I would give you two answers. First of all, how were they prepared? I believe he said they were prepared by someone else. And number two, he says in his testimony that he was a full-time employee of the Nevada Oral Facial Surgery. So if he's full-time employed by that entity, then he also has to show his 500 hours of material participation in this entity as well. And if he's full-time employed, I'm not sure that if he meant full-time, then that means full-time. What he's saying is I was part-time employed by NOFS, and I was part-time working in this other investment. And I think that would take him out of contention for material participation under the regulation. But I think just the airline logs alone, again, that all that shows is that he's flying his plane. He had other things going on. I don't think that is reliable with respect to the number of hours. He has to testify what he
did. Counsel, why isn't that just an issue for the trier of fact? Whether or not airplane logs is substantial enough, substantiates it enough, or why can't the testimony alone be substantial enough if the trier of fact believes him?
Well, you have to have some type of reliable corroborative evidence in order to make the claim.
Is that by statute? Where does that rule come from?
Well, that's the case law. I think we cite some cases in there. Maybe it was Antonishin that your testimony alone is not enough to establish that you are. That's the sort of what we said before, the ballpark guesstimate that you do after the fact, that's insufficient, because anybody can come and say that, oh, I worked these hours. But what we need is additional evidence to show us that, in fact, you did that, to corroborate that evidence, to corroborate that testimony.
What if his testimony is typically I worked half a day or 3 days a week or whatever, and it's corroborated by airplane log showing him going to Las Vegas about that number of times over the course of a year? Why isn't that not enough to defeat a summary judgment?
Well, under some circumstances, it could be, but not here, I think, because that's not what they did. What he did was provide a K-1 showing, and I'm going to get to the second reason here, showing that he had a loss from his partnership. We said a second thing in the brief. Remember, there are two parts to his claim. He also has to show that he was not reimbursed for the expenses. Just showing a loss from the partnership isn't enough. He has to show that he had not been paid back. And he said in his testimony that he had no way to do that.
Well, how would he do that? How would he show that he wasn't paid back?
Well, he would show what expenses he had. He's claiming a lot of money in unreimbursed expenses, but he would have, that's his burden to demonstrate whether or not they in fact were unreimbursed. That the burden is on him to show that. All he has is a K-1 that he received from the partnership showing a loss.
So what you're talking about is receipts showing that he actually incurred the expense.
Correct. And so whether or not.
Okay, go ahead. How do you show that it's not reimbursed to him?
Well, I mean, he was asked, I think, in his testimony, whether or not he was asked specifically, this is on ER 469. So do you know what kind of unreimbursed partnership expenses did you have working with Clear Choice? And then later he answers, you don't know specifically. He says, no, specifically, no. He had a W-2, but he has to be able to show what his losses are. And he doesn't seem to be able to do that. With respect to Mrs. Johnson, I think, you know, she has to hit the 750-hour mark. We all agree on that. In her case, it wasn't a substantiation issue. It was her own concessions. That's what the court focused on. The court focused on her own concessions of four categories that she said don't apply to rental real estate management. So she said her investment counsel conversations. She said work on her personal home, work with respect to airplane hangar, and study for real estate exams. Though the court said, because of her own admission that those categories were not relevant to rental real estate, those come out. Now, as Mr. Smeltzer indicated, she had several different versions of logs that she had prepared, and she faults the court for not identifying which logs that it used. First of all, in our brief, we indicate how we did the math. It's pretty straightforward subtraction. But here's page 8 of her reply brief. She says that because the original logs lacked some specificity, Mrs. Johnson updated them using whatever information was available at the time to produce a more detailed description of activities. The purpose was to add more detail, not to change entries. So if essentially the logs are identical, then it was just simply a matter of looking to where it said real estate exam or looking to where it said investment counsel and doing the subtraction. And that in all cases takes her under the 750-hour mark.
Mr. Wasserman, was the district court correct that studying for the real estate exam not qualify as a service under the 750-hour rule?
Yes, they don't challenge it on appeal, and I think Mr. Smeltzer indicated also that there are a number of cases that say merely studying for the real estate exam. Remember, she did not take those real estate exams either, and she also indicated in her papers that they had no bearing on whether or not she is a real estate professional. That is to say, under the regulation, you can be a real estate professional presumably without actually having to take those exams, and that's why she said it had no bearing. So we would argue that that the study that she did with respect to that exam is really irrelevant here. I think that's what the district court
said. Yeah, I'm just wondering, though, as a matter of text, it seems like it says services that relate to property trades or business. It seems like studying for a real estate exam does relate to trades or businesses. So I just don't understand where the district court made that ruling from.
So in the regulation, it has to be more than one half of the personal services. So is it a personal service that's performed studying for a real estate exam? I think that would be the issue in the regulation. Is it considered a personal service that is provided? I guess that's where the courts come down with respect
right.
to that.
I think the regulation defines it as any work related to real estate property or real estate property trades or businesses. It just seems like studying for a bar exam, for example, or a real estate license would be any work related to the practice of law. So why not studying for a real estate exam is related to the practice of being a real estate agent?
So I think it may be very well with respect to that definition of personal services, whether or not that in fact would cover the studying. But again, we don't think that they appealed it and they don't seem to be making that issue here. And again, I think below she said it had no bearing, and that's what the court said. So she has conceded that issue. I would also add that to the extent that she claims that the court did not view the evidence in the light most favorable to her. So in fact, I think she did. The court did view the evidence in the light most favorable to her. It did apply the summary judgment standard appropriately, because it didn't doubt whether or not she studied for those hours. It didn't doubt whether or not she actually met with her investment counsel. It didn't doubt whether or not she did work on her personal property. The court accepted her testimony, but that's why she lost, because those hours get deducted. I would also indicate, and I think this is kind of unusual, she also makes the argument in her appeal that references to work on her personal home, and she seems to be disputing a bit where her personal residence is. It was Moon Valley, and the court simply subtracted hours that listed Moon Valley from her logs, showing so she's unable as a matter of law to hit the 750 mark. What they say on appeal is, well, she may have done work with respect to unspecified rental properties from her. That's certainly a novel argument, but the reason that fails is because you have to show a genuine dispute of material fact. But if you look at what they actually say, it's on page 15 of their reply brief, they're unwilling to say, because it's contrary to the record, that she actually was doing any work on rental properties. What they say is, those entries, quote, might refer to their own home, but could also refer to research on remodeling for any of the other rental properties that Mrs. Johnson managed. And so that isn't pointing to a dispute of material fact. That is avoiding a dispute of material fact. That is saying that, you know, maybe she did this, maybe she did that. We're unwilling to say now. What we like to do is have a trial, and then we'll tell you what she's doing. But that is not the appropriate summary judgment standard. The fact is the district court got it right and properly applied the summary judgment standard, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman. Mr. Smeltzer?
Sure, Your Honor. So first off, a lot of those arguments are the same ones that were made against our opening brief. And what we said in our reply brief is it doesn't change the fact that there was more than tax return information in the record in order to support the claims. It doesn't change that. It also doesn't change the fact that there were multiple logs. We believe that a dispute still existed, and the only way to get Mr. Hausch's deductions denied was to ignore the fact that there were other evidence there. The denial isn't about the reliability of Mr. Hausch's testimony. It isn't about the reliability of the airplane logs. or the hours involved. And those can be estimated, and you only need about 9 hours a week in order to meet the 500 hours that would qualify under the statute. So it's not like he has to substantiate substantial amounts of time each week while he's working at his other job. If he can justify 9 hours a week doing these various clear choice entities, traveling there, doing the training, doing the teaching, working on them, even phone calls there to deal with those investment things, he would get to the 500 hour requirement that way. And the problem with the real estate professional that I'll deal with in my last section is we are disputing that those entries may still qualify, because as your honor kind of hit on, the fact is that studying for a real estate exam can have a dual purpose of both providing her with skills she needs to be a real estate professional, in addition to helping her know what she needs to pass the exam, whether or not she passed it or not. And so that can be a dual purpose thing, and that's something we believe needs to be resolved at trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Smeltzer. This case is submitted, and this court stands in recess until tomorrow, 9 a.m.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This court for this session stands adjourned.